This is The Brief with Justin Poder, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and me, John Elmer. The Afghanistan Papers. In December, The Washington Post published a trove of internal documents and interviews with those in charge of the war in Afghanistan. The takeaway? They knew they were losing, and they lied about it from the very first days of the 20-year war and occupation.
We're such a strong country, but we have gotten away from the idea of actually how to win anything. And there's a machinery that's behind, you know, what we do. And it keeps us participating in the conflict because it generates wealth, actually.
Welcome to a bonus episode of The Brief on the Afghanistan Papers. Thank you for subscribing. Well, let's get right into it.
The Briefing.
So the Afghanistan Papers are a release that the Washington Post got of an audit from the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. It was an independent body set up by Congress in 2008 to examine waste and fraud in the Afghan war. If we remember back 2008, Obama's elected essentially on the pretense of withdrawing from Afghanistan. And so they were looking at a lessons learned plan to produce a report, as government audit institutions do, to diagnose policy mistakes, you know, to do imperial invasion right the next time. And so the main meat of the Afghanistan Papers is actually 400 interviews with main stakeholders, policymakers, generals, diplomats, aid workers, White House officials, even soldiers on the ground, Afghan stakeholders as well, some NATO officials. They're interviews, long-form interviews with the participants themselves. So the interesting backstory to the Afghanistan Papers is that they came out of the election campaign for Trump when Michael Flynn took a key role in Trump's campaign. And Michael Flynn was an American general, part of the American military intelligence apparatus in Afghanistan at the time. And when he came into the Trump campaign, he was, of course, famous for the lock her up chants. And he was very front and center in Trump's barnstorming campaign events. So the Washington Post was looking into Flynn and had heard that he had done a long interview on Afghanistan. They filed the Freedom of Information Act request, essentially because Flynn was in the news for the Trump campaign stuff. This goes back to August 2016. When the Washington Post heard about this interview with Flynn, they thought it would be useful because of his prominence in the media at the time. They asked for it through a Freedom of Information Act request that was originally granted, and the process was unfolding to get the documents for him. When Trump gets elected, the Freedom of Information Act request for the interview was rejected. The Washington Post carried out a 3-year legal fight, 2 lawsuits, attempting to get these original documents that form the Afghanistan Papers, more than 2,000 pages of reports and interviews, direct interviews with participants in the war.
I mean, there are so many, you know, quotes to pull from the interviews that were done. One of my favorite, I guess, is just this one word from Donald Rumsfeld in a memo to several generals and senior aides. You know, he's talking about we're never going to get the U.S. military out of Afghanistan unless we take care to see that there's something going on that will provide the stability that will be necessary for us to leave. Right. That was the general the currency through which they sold this war and kind of endless occupation, that if we pulled out, the country would disintegrate. But under that, he wrote "help" with an exclamation point. That was in 2002, so just 6 months after the invasion and occupation began. What does it say about the fact that, you know, Rumsfeld already knew that the U.S., you know, was engaged in an unwinnable, you know, whatever winning means, occupation and war, and that this narrative that the U.S. was there as like this benevolent peacekeeping force? What does that say about where the U.S. actually knew itself to be especially in the context of the history of Afghanistan, where, of course, empires go to die.
Well, if we remember, the war began in 2001 as a response to the attacks of September 11th. The war was originally framed essentially as a revenge operation against al-Qaeda to kill and capture al-Qaeda members that were said to be involved in the September 11th plannings. But the war, of course, al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan was tiny. It was a safe haven. They were essentially contained by the Taliban at the time. When the invasion happens, the first 6 months of the war is, you know, the Taliban fall, and the war is focused at that point, we're told, on al-Qaeda. But the war quickly becomes not that. It quickly becomes an insurgency. The Taliban fade away into the mountains to fight a guerrilla war, and the American operation in Afghanistan becomes like the sort of case study of mission creep. Essentially, these memos, Rumsfeld makes up a large portion of the memos. Rumsfeld was famous within his circles for what he called snowflakes, which were little memos that he would drop throughout the course of the day, like his little ideas that his staffers would transcribe. And the bulk of the Afghanistan papers are Rumsfeld, his defense secretary at the time, sorting through the war in Afghanistan. And as probably Justin can do with a little bit of background on Afghanistan, the Americans go in there with very little understanding of the political milieu that they're entering. But they do have the sort of underpinnings of trying to avoid another Vietnam, another quagmire in Afghanistan.
Justin?
What John said about it being a revenge operation is dead on, because at the beginning, there were two missions very quickly. There was one called Operation Enduring Freedom. So, you know, lots of puns in the anti-war movement about how Afghans were going to be made to endure all this freedom. And then the stabilization mission, ISAF. So the stabilization mission was the benevolent peacekeeping side of things. And then OEF was, supposedly going to hunt al-Qaeda out in the south around Kandahar and in their holdouts. Those two objectives were never going to get along, right? And also both were, it's quite possible that both are excuses, both are alibis. So nobody really ever believed that the U.S. occupied Afghanistan to free women from the yoke of the Taliban or anything like that. But so the benevolent stability kind of argument was always understood as an alibi. I think even in the papers, for the most part, in these Afghanistan papers, this is understood. Mm-hmm. The revenge side of it is also a little bit of an alibi because of how little Afghanistan had to do with 9/11, right? John was saying that al-Qaeda was contained in Afghanistan. In some sense, they were guests of the Taliban, but the Taliban weren't responsible for 9/11. The Taliban were kind of a Pakistan supported, you know, they had some support among the Pashtun people in the south. They were the most powerful, you know, armed group among many Islamist armed groups in Afghanistan at that time when it was invaded. So they had won most of 2/3 of the country in 2001. They had the whole country. They had the capital. They had Kabul, but there was this northern alliance of other mujahideen, and those other mujahideen were the ones who the Americans sided with in the 2001 war, and they came and they brought those people into power. So the idea that it was like some kind of liberation from, you know, a certain kind of really restrictive theological regime that the Taliban had, well, those were the same kinds of people that were installed in power in 2001 and remain in power today. So all of those, both revenge and development or stability or democracy, none of them really quite explain or fit what the U.S. was doing there in the mm-hmm. first place and what they've been doing there for so long. And I think that part of the reason it's impossible to, they keep talking about how we're losing or winning or we don't know how to win and that kind of idea that keeps coming up in the Afghanistan papers that we can talk more about, is because the objectives were never the stated ones. And so, you know, what I think they're doing there is, you know, establishing presence in the region, establishing a presence close to Pakistan. You know, there's a whole geopolitical thing that they're doing there that has nothing to do with revenge after 9/11 and has nothing to do with stabilizing the country or bringing the fruits of Western liberalism to the country.
And we were all saying this. I mean, I hate to say that like that, but you know, people in the anti-war left around the world were saying that, you know, the stated reasons for invading and occupying Afghanistan were not the ones that were actually, you know, being carried out by the US and allied forces. And we, you know, people on the anti-war left were written off as, you know, crazy kooks who were, you know, especially in this country, you know, unpatriotic and
completely.
And yet, you know, 18 years later, 19 years later, here we are.
Yeah, which is why I also kind of think, you know, I wonder what you guys think of this, but I also think of even the release of these papers as a part of the whole propaganda system. So I'm asking myself, like, why is this coming out now?
Right.
Why, you know, why are these pieces present in the papers and other pieces not present in the papers?
A lot of it, especially in the first part, you know, it's like a 6 or 7 part series from the Washington Post. In the first part, there's a lot of emphasis on the number of U.S. military casualties. So like, you know, the discrepancies in the numbers between what, you know, how many soldiers were actually killed versus what the U.S. government said. And, you know, obviously, there's always going to be a discrepancy when empire is trying to protect itself. But that, I feel like that was kind of the focus of at least the first section of this, where like, you know, that was the lead that they went with, was like, you know, not that the invasion and occupation completely decimated, you know, Afghanistan and regional countries, but that, you know, there was, they lied about the number of troops being killed.
Yeah. And there's also, while we're criticizing the papers and the kinds of things that they're saying in the papers, there's also like this whole, and this also goes back to the 19th century, the way the British Empire used to write about Afghanistan. It's like, we're the victims of Afghans, you know? It's like these Afghans, you know, they're out to kill us. And it kind of reminds me of like Catch 22 or something, where he's doing these bombing runs and he's really upset that the Germans are trying to kill him. And they're like, well, you are bombing them. And he's like, what does that have to do with it? I went and looked at some of these papers, and I'm always interested in what the academics are saying. So there's a professor at the Naval Academy, Thomas Johnson. So I read his briefing. That was about 60 pages. And there was some interesting stuff in there. He recommends a book by a guy named Anand Gopal. And the book is called something like No Good Men Among the Living. So it's came out, I don't know, 2014 or something. And he goes and meets this Taliban guy, this mullah. And he says, you know, he says something like, the strangest thing to me was how this man came to declare war on America, as if this guy was hanging out in his village and then just up and decided to make war on America, and as if America didn't come to him, you know? So there's just that like innocence of, you know, poor us, and why are these people so upset with us is present, not just in the way they write about the papers, but in the papers themselves, because these kinds of assumptions and premises are the starting point of the people that make these decisions to go on to these wars, like Rumsfeld or the people that are helping with the counterinsurgency.
Right.
Well, there's interviews with the soldiers in the Afghanistan papers, and there's one with Jonathan Rosario. He's a 31-year-old army infantryman who went to Kandahar province, and he says, so they were telling us to go into the villages and ask them, where is the Taliban? And the first time we asked the question, they were like, oh, yes, I'm Taliban. And we were like, do we shoot this guy? He's just admitted he's Taliban. So we asked the interpreter, and the interpreter said, Taliban means student. They're all students out here. So that was very confusing. And that's what Rumsfeld is saying with that quote, that that memo that Nora cited. When he says help, he's saying we have no human intelligence on the ground. We have no idea. I mean, they use these idiotic terms like bad guys. You know, we had no idea who the bad guys were.
Right.
We were expecting to show up and have a map presented to them that said, like, you know, here's the bad guys. This is the area. Go clear the bad guys from the area. The basic human intelligence in Afghanistan, as we saw, of course, with Iraq a couple of years later, was essentially non-existent for this entire fight.
So there's another, there's just to riff off of that, there's another interesting thing in the paper, in the interview with this Dr. Johnson, this professor at the Naval Academy.
A good percentage of the people in Gitmo should never have been in Gitmo. I mean, they were given away by tribes. They were given away by other traditional tribal enemies that claimed they were Taliban or Al Qaeda. And Gopal really highlights and documents this in his very, very good book.
And he's citing Anand Gopal's book. A good percentage of the people in Gitmo, that's Guantanamo Bay, the people that were rendered from Afghanistan as prisoners of war, enemy combatants, they were called, and taken to prison in occupied portion of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. So people are using the Americans to settle scores between, you know, their enemies, because they know that if you point to someone you don't like and tell the Americans that's a Taliban, you can get them to go and shoot them or arrest them or whatever it is.
The early part of the war, though, is important to say that the justification when they entered the war in Afghanistan was that it was going to be quick. I mean, Bush gives this statement early on where he says, you know, like, it might take a day, it might take a week, it might take a month. They aren't really saying it might take, in public, it might take 20 years to be at the point that they literally were at the beginning, if not in a worse position than they were at the beginning. And there was this kind of like idea that they were going to go in with special forces. You know, there was the classic U.S. special forces on horseback that went around with the beards and whatnot, and that they would go and put a government, you know, what the term came when the counterinsurgency war began, sort of government in a box, that they would drive out the Taliban, put in their sympathetic force, and then essentially the idea was essentially withdraw. Of course, the Americans have never given up any of their bases. They're still in Japan and Korea, and the record of them leaving is thin. But that was the pretense at the time, was that it was going to be a short war, and that the definition of victory became an important part of the narrative that we were told constantly throughout this entire war.
So there's two pieces worth taking up about that. And one is that all the weird stuff that went on during that war, where they created a corridor for the Pakistani trainers and Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, Pakistani intelligence that were the sponsors and trainers and handlers of Taliban and probably Al-Qaeda as well. And the Americans allowed them all to escape. You know, they kind of set up a situation where they could all just kind of fly out and get out, because it would have been so embarrassing to be arresting and rounding up all these senior Pakistani intelligence figures, Pakistan being their ally that's allowing them to, you know, use their bases to get into Afghanistan in the first place, and who's feeding their troops in Afghanistan during this occupation. So there's a whole thing with Pakistan that happened to ensure that the really embarrassing aspects of the, you know, U.S. supporting Pakistan, Pakistan supporting the Taliban, didn't get out. And then the other thing about, you know, the government in a box, because I noticed in the Afghanistan papers, there's a little bit of talk in 2002, I think, about the Marshall Plan and how we need a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan, a Marshall Plan being the plan that they enacted after World War II to rebuild Europe after Europe was destroyed by World War II. And the difference is, like, the way that reconstruction occurred in Afghanistan and Iraq post 2001 or 2003 has been based on these neoliberal premises. So it's like, back in 45, from 45 to 73, there was an idea of, like, the state being the leader in development. And now privatization and those neoliberal assumptions are so fundamental to everything that the US does that they're not able to even build a state. They don't have that capacity anymore, because the whole idea of like everything has to go through private, everything has to be subcontracted, and everybody has to, all these businesses have to make money along the way, rather than trying to accomplish some, you know, nation building or state building goal.
But none of this stuff was new. Like, the report talks a lot about corruption, and it talks a lot about the way the money was used, right? Like, there hasn't been an official government, comprehensive government accounting of the war, but, you know, the numbers are in the trillions for amount spent.
Yeah.
But this was known at the time. Like, if, as a Canadian, you know, the home of Michael Ignatieff, if we can remember that the main essay in the New York Times magazine, you know, in October 2001, just basically setting the neoliberal parameters of the war in Afghanistan, had that classic quote where he says, "Kabul is the Klondike of the new century, a place where a young person can make, if not a fortune, then a stellar career riding the tide of international money that is flooding into every United Nations flight from Islamabad. It's one of the few places where a bright spark right out of college can end up in a job that comes with a servant and a driver. So Kabul has the social attractions of a colonial outpost joined with the feverish excitement of a boon town. But unlike the Klondike, this gold rush is being paid for not by speculators and panhandlers, but by rich Western governments. Empire means big government," he says. So like at the time, you know, some of the reporting on the Afghanistan papers, which if perhaps if it weren't for the Trump impeachment stuff pushing everything out of the news, would have been, well, maybe, I don't know, I guess we could talk about that, but would it have been the biggest story at the time? But it's definitely not a big story today. But one of the main themes is these reporters, you know, at NPR and whatnot, kind of aghast, like how we've been lied to this whole time. Right from the start, that neoliberal impetus for the war was laid out by, you know, the sort of the best and the brightest of this generation, as they, you know, with quote, with scare quotes around that.
But yeah. But even the corruption is spun in the papers as our victimization at the hands of these crafty Afghans. So it's like, here's a really good one. So they go in, the Americans go in, and they want to do some reconstruction, right, along with their war. So they go and they pay this, they open some schools. So this is Thomas Johnson.
And one of the regular things they did is that the people that were actually paying for the construction of these different buildings or whatever they were with, they were schools or district centers, the Afghans would have Polaroid or pictures of a completed one. And they would go up because these were non-permissive areas, and usually the people didn't want to travel out and look at the actual results of their money on their own. So the people in Kandahar, this was sort of a black economy type of thing. They would show pictures and the people say, "Oh, good, there it is, it's finished." So, you know, that $80,000 just went into somebody's pocket. The building was never really built. They were, the people that were funding it were shown a picture and then they walked away. And I saw this happen on a number of occasions in Kandahar.
They paid their school teachers the equivalent of about $80, $60 if you were uncertified, $80 if you were a certified teacher. Thomas Johnson again.
They had a couple of schools in Baybog. They paid their school teachers the equivalent of about $80, $60 if you were uncertified, and $80 if you're a certified teacher for their classrooms. But we're paying the ditch diggers, you know, I think 90 or 100, the equivalent of $100 a week. So initially, all the school teachers quit their jobs and joined the ditch diggers. So, you know, we had to recalculate and
so initially, all the school teachers quit their jobs and joined the ditch diggers. So they just...
And the schools that were built, right, were like these white schools that became known as symbols in the area. No one went, you know, within a mile of them. And they were ultimately...
Yeah, you take pictures.
Yeah, but they were just used as military outposts by the insurgency, essentially, because they were, nobody was going to use them as a school because they were like painted white as a target of the imperial project.
Well, yeah. And then you can say you built the school, you show a picture of the school, and then you collect your money, you know, as one of the sub contractors. So as long as the money changes hands, you know, the everything is working out, right? Everybody's getting paid. So the occupation is gold. What is it? It's diamonds if it's the Klondike. But it's
oil
paying off. Yeah.
You're listening to The Brief with John, Justin, and me, Nora. Follow us on Twitter at The Brief Pod. And now back to The Brief.
So one of the things that the Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction does in these Afghanistan papers is to cite the lessons learned. It's to fix the policy mistakes. And one of the things that they target, of course, is the sort of waste and corruption in government. Maybe we can use this opportunity to talk a little bit about the government in a box that was implemented in Afghanistan under the rule of Hamid Karzai.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So Karzai is an interesting, a really interesting figure. So, you know, he showed up at the very end of the invasion in 2001 on the ground in Afghanistan. So there's a book by Ahmed Rashid, who's a Pakistani writer, you know, a good writer. He's mentioned in Iqbal Ahmed's book as someone who was a real leftist, like involved in armed struggle in Baluch. In the 80s. But Rashid, he came out really, really liking Karzai. So there's the book Descent into Chaos that I read. It's from a long time ago, like I think 2008 or before. But it's like a lot of it is a bio of Karzai and how Karzai came to be the one that was chosen one. So, but Karzai had this prestige to be able to hold together a coalition of the Mujahideen. So there are different warlords that joined the government in different capacities. So Rashid Dostum is this, he's a warlord. He has this political party called Junbash, and he's still active, although he's close to retirement age now. There's Ismail Khan, which is the warlord of Herat, and there were people from the valley, the Panjshir Valley, where Ahmed Shah Massoud was from. So Massoud was the most, you know, he was the most beloved of the warlords by the Americans. They really liked Massoud. He was a Tajik warlord, for people who, you know, pay attention to that. And he was actually assassinated by Al-Qaeda a couple of days before 9/11. And his battle plan for defeating the Taliban was more or less, he was trying to pitch that plan in the year and a half before his death to the West. He was, you know, kind of arguing, like, if I could get the air support and I could do that, the Northern Alliance can beat the Taliban. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that the West was very interested in until 9/11. But after 9/11, they kind of picked that up. Massoud never lived to see it. But if you go to, I was in Afghanistan in 2013, and there are huge billboards of Karzai, yes, but also of Massoud all over town in Kabul, everywhere as this great martyr. So anyway, Karzai was the one who brought these warlords together. And there was a pretty fair election in 2004. People did vote. And, you know, there was, you know, it was billed as like a super, super exciting moment. In some ways it was for Afghans. It really was. The 2009 election was less so. And that was, you know, widely recognized to have been stolen for Karzai. So what's interesting about like the 2014 election and this one, the current one right now, is the 2014 election, a Massoud kind of mentee named Abdullah, he sort of refused to recognize the result of the election, which was Ashraf Ghani, who was kind of a technocrat, pro-US, you know, like they're all pro-US, but this guy was more of a technocrat kind of type, U.S. educated kind of leader, as opposed to having strong links to one of the warlords. And Abdullah was close to Ahmed Shah Massoud, and he refused to recognize the result, leading to the Americans creating a position called chief executive just for him. So it was like, we have basically a co-presidency just so that we can have everybody get along. And that was Abdullah. The 2019 election, talk about government in a box. The 2019 election took place on September 28th, of this year, 2019.
How meaningful can these elections be, though, when you have the Taliban boycotting them? You have like security in most of the provinces tenuous enough to make like an election day a dangerous pursuit. How related to the world in Afghanistan is the election compared to the sort of necessity for the Americans to have like a fig leaf of democracy over it?
Yeah, I mean, my sense is it is still like elections are still significant events in Afghanistan. Afghans that I know like talk about the different candidates. They talk about the politics. The Taliban, you know, there are definitely people that support the Taliban and think it's all, you know, a sham. But there are also people that are, you know, kind of like not happy with the Taliban, even people who are like inclined to those kinds of politics that are not thrilled with the Taliban boycotting the process, or, you know, they just think like, if you guys ran, you probably, because that's an interesting point. Like there's a guy named Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. He's probably the most vicious of the warlords, right? And he's famous for like being the guy who throws acid at women students on the university campus and all this kind of stuff, going back into the late 70s. And he ran in the election for president. I wouldn't say that the election's totally irrelevant, like a complete fig leaf. But on the other hand, your point about like whatever the result of the election, the most important thing about the outcome is that it has to be acceptable to the US, right? And so when Ghani won in 2014 and Abdullah Abdullah was like, no, I'm not going to be part of this, the US kind of found a way to patch it up because that's more important than, you know, respecting the electoral results or the will of the Afghan people.
How is the US still able to glean this much control and power in Afghanistan, you know, 18 years later? It seems like there's no interest for the US at this point militarily. Like, why are they even trying anymore to influence and you know, do this government in a box?
I just think the way that the US works, they never want to surrender any influence anywhere to anyone. And in Afghanistan, if they were to the extent that they take a step back, the regional powers that step up are Iran, which has a lot of historical influence in Afghanistan, and Russia, which also has a lot of historical influence in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and is not, you know, it's been so long since that war that Russia's also not despised the way that it was back, you know, even 20 years ago and when the Americans first invaded. Right. So I just think that, you know, this whole empire, great game kind of thing that has been going on since the 19th century is enough justification to continue to intervene and install who they want. There are stories, like there's a book by William Dalrymple, I think, called The Return of the King. And it's about the British Empire installing a king, you know, getting rid of the king they didn't like and trying to install a different one, a king named Shah Shuja, and all the disastrous military campaigns and the disaster that it was for Afghanistan. And it's like really, really a pattern. It's a really incredible pattern of the way the empires just abuse Afghanistan.
Right.
You know?
We have all these people with their careers based on it too, right? When you go back to that Ignatieff quote about the Klondike, you have an entire generation of apparatchiks who are now tied to. I mean, how do you get out of Afghanistan without, you know, saying it was a defeat? I mean, this is something that's kind of described in academic terms as the Afghan paradox, which is that they built this entire sort of government in a box apparatus. They built this counterinsurgency narrative, you know, three block war, the three D's, development, defense, and diplomacy working together, the kind of dovetailing of the two things we talked about, the military operation and the sort of the reconstruction Marshall Plan type, was dovetailed together, tied together, and created an entire generation of career counterinsurgents who can't have a defeat, can't withdraw from Afghanistan in defeat because they've tied this whole history of their, you know, their careers, their individual careers,
right?
This war. And that's at all levels too, right? Because that's all, like, you're talking about the military level, but the development level is the same. So it's like, I landed, when we landed in Kabul in 2013, like, we ran into some mysterious, you know, American development worker dude who was like, hey man, like, come to this part. He gave me his card and he was like, come to this party. Like, this is a great town to party in.
Wow.
And, and like, we went to this like kind of restaurant and a friend of mine was like pointing out like a guy who was one of the big warlord's sons who was like sitting with his entourage and stuff. And then, I just picked up this magazine. And it's like this magazine for expats, right? Like people who are hanging out. And there's like this whole section about how it's not polite to have a separate entrance to your house for Afghans and how you should let Afghans enter through the front door because it's, after all, their country.
Oh my
and
God.
It just gives you a flavor of like what's, you know, what it's really like, you know, to be there, you know, and how exactly like how this is like a career stepping stone for every kind of worker, like whether you're a military type or a development worker or a, you know, aspiring bureaucrat or whatever.
Well, that's the Afghan paradox, is that so they create this Klondike and then it becomes associated, Afghanistan becomes associated with this counterinsurgency war, the importance of development aid. And the paradox is that it builds up this entire culture of empire with the NGOs, you know, making hundreds of, making billions of dollars, making tens of billions of dollars in this process. But that the paradox is that if the war is associated with this kind of development aid, that if it's seen as a failure, then the next time you want to do it, the population won't be as supportive of what's going on. And so in part, that's what the lessons learned of this Afghanistan papers was. It was like to learn the lessons so that we don't make mistakes for the next time around. And the paradox is if it works, then you have this massive apparatus that's been created. And if the war is seen as a failure, you've essentially undone all of these careers that are tied to this type of warfare, which is essentially what has happened, right, with the Iraq war. I mean, part of the reason why we're still talking about Afghanistan 18 years later is because, you know, within, 6 months of the war in Afghanistan, Rumsfeld had already moved on to how we were going to invade, you know, how they were going to build up the case for the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And these, both of these wars will be seen as, rather than, you know, the great game that Justin was talking about, or as a way of American influence, that these wars will be seen as impossible and that the Americans will, you know, lose the capability of carrying out large scale weaponized military adventures in far flung lands. If it kind of gets the Vietnam syndrome, right? The term, the kind of idea that these kind of large scale military invasions and occupations are seen as defeats and a waste and not a way for the Americans to interact on a global scale.
There's something in this that reminds me of Palestine. Like, I was thinking about Jeff Halper's book, The War Against the Planet, and how he talks about, you know, the whole industry of weapons, but also the industry of population control. So it's like, it's not just weapons of warfare, the way you'd understand like Napoleonic war of two armies clashing on a battlefield, but it's like warfare as a model for managing populations around the world on behalf of, you know, elites. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, urban. And one of the big marketers of this is Israel.
Sure.
And testing it out on Palestinians. And so it's sort of like the whole idea isn't really to win, but to manage. Mm-hmm. Like it's a kind of a management of conflict. So you can manage it. You don't necessarily even want it to end, because while it goes on, everybody keeps getting paid and everything keeps happening in the way it's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And they did that they actually broke down that strategy in 2006 and started launching this counterinsurgency game. They called it the three-block war. The idea, the first block, you fight a military. The second block is sort of policing and security, and the third block is the delivering of aid. They moved the conflict away from, which is also what Israel does, away from military on military into how to control the population from using the co-optation through the NGO apparatus and the policing. So the American war in Afghanistan was focused considerably on the creation of the Afghan National Security Forces, which have, you know, as part of the government in a box, that you have to create security forces. You have to create allied security forces from scratch, essentially out of whole cloth.
Well, right. And you know, we see that with the Palestinian security forces under, you know, the Palestinian Authority leadership that are there to essentially subcontract the occupation from Israel. The government in a box is the definition of the Palestinian Authority currently. You know, it's been what, like 13 years since the PA has had elections, and you know, there's no prospect on the horizon for elections at this moment, precisely because they know that the PA in its current form with Fatah leading it probably would not survive, you know, the popular consensus as it didn't in 2006. But yeah, and then and of course it's a cash cow. Of course it's like, you know, Israel has constructed the perfect scenario for population management. You make the Palestinian Authority look like an autonomous, you know, independent democratic system. You flood it with you know, essentially bribes to keep, you know, their control over the prison population essentially in place. And then you make the PA the largest employer in the West Bank, so that people will think twice about voting for an opposition party in an election that will never happen, because that would mean the, you know, dissolution of their family's income. So yeah, I mean, that's been, you know, the strategy of colonial empires for the last century, to make an occupied population completely dependent on the occupier, and to present a model of like this, you know, this like this facade of democracy when it's anything but. And yeah, absolutely.
So here's the problem they have in Afghanistan that I don't know. Do they have this? And tell me if they have this in Palestine. Like, what they would do is they would raise a unit of the Afghan military and they'd train them and equip them. And then those guys would promptly go and join the Taliban. Thank you very much. Off we go to join the Taliban.
Wow. John would know more about that.
Yeah, or they didn't exist at all, right? Like, there was this whole phenomena of ghost soldiers where they'd train, the name was on a piece of paper only, and then they would take the funds and divert them. Because the joint, unlike in Palestine, I mean, the situation in Afghanistan is joining these security forces essentially is a ticket to death, right? The casualty rates of these Afghan security forces fighting the Taliban is off the charts. It's not a sustainable level. There's been more than 60,000 security forces killed, you know, in the recent years. And the numbers today are higher than they were last year, which are higher than they were the year before. So when we're talking about metrics in the Afghanistan papers, the one metric that's very clear to denote that you're losing is when your security forces casualty rates increase each year, year on year, 18 years on. I mean, it's worth just noting, just anecdotally, that soldiers who are fighting in Afghanistan today, who sign up to join the military today, were not born on September 11th. You have the second generation of soldiers going to war, people's parents and then their kids going to war. And in that time, you have a worse, you know, counterinsurgency dilemma than you had the year before.
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to say that from the Afghan perspective, like, the Taliban are from 96, right? And the war among the Mujahideen is from 92. You know, the fall of the last kind of central government was 91, right? It was, I guess, Yeltsin sort of negotiated it away. And so it's been going on a lot longer. And but the point you make, that only reinforces the point you're making, John, which is that like these are generations that didn't know anything about the previous generation of the war, but the war continues nonetheless. There's yet one other element I did want to mention, which comes up in this paper, the one paper that I read, kind of like every page of, which is this Thomas Johnson interview. And they're talking about the drug war. And, you know, we're going to have to come back to this drug war on the show probably more than once. I just have to take this moment to praise Karzai. You know, there's not a lot to praise Karzai over, but Karzai, you know, the U.S. government wanted to do aerial fumigation in Afghanistan to just have the drug war in Afghanistan, right? To fumigate the poppy fields. Afghanistan has historically grown poppy. They've grown, you know, poppy and produced opiates. Iran produces it for the legal, you know, for the medicinal market and potentially others. So does Pakistan. So there's big business there too, right? There's big illegal capitalism going on with this commodity that is the poppy. And I again, like when you study this, you see that this is also a part of why, you know, the US has such an interest in the region. And historically has, you know, including going back to the 80s. But Karzai resisted. Karzai, I'm just going to quote this. Karzai thought that aerial fumigation would be seen by Afghans as chemical warfare against them. He had concerns that their fruits and water system, the health of the kids could be affected. So, you know, good on him. Good on him for blocking that.
How did the U.S. take that?
You know, I guess they didn't really want to do it that much. I mean, I think the drug war is like a classic example of, you know, it's like the immigration debate, right? It's like there are people that really, really, there are elites that really, really want immigration. And there are, you know, people that take advantage of the, you know, racism towards immigrants. In the same way, like there are elites that really, really want poppy to be grown. Mm-hmm. And there are others that take advantage of the puritanical, you know, Victorian attitudes towards drugs that fuel the drug war.
Just linking this Afghanistan papers to, you know, the naming convention that it's used is obviously an allusion to the Pentagon papers, which were released in 1971, the end part of the war in Vietnam, which was also a generational war.
Yeah, it was six administrations.
The Pentagon papers, let me just summarize them. They were a different report than the Afghanistan papers. The Pentagon papers were a report commissioned by the Secretary of Defense at the time that actually blocked direct interviews. It's just based on internal documents, and it's a report. I think it's a RAND. It's a RAND Corporation report.
It was.
But the papers came at a time when the public fervor was significant. Whereas the war in Afghanistan, the Afghanistan papers is like, you could be forgiven for not seeing coverage of the Afghanistan papers recently. The context of the time, I guess, is what I'm saying is, in terms of sort of managing empire, how significant we see the role of a lack of an anti-war movement today, or the way that the conflict used the sort of human rights, as Justin said earlier, the sort of that the war in Afghanistan was about how many, you know, girls went to school or how many schools were built. How much of that impacts the removal of the war in Afghanistan from a source of conflict, from a contested space to, you know, sort of the back pages of the newspaper.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the lack of a real anti-war movement and the, you know, really the stenography of the centers of power by corporate media. That was, you know, it was different back, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, especially coverage of the war as it was happening. That was, you know, that was being shown in every, you know, network television screen in every home every night for years and years and years. And when the Bush administration, you know, launched the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and then later the invasion and occupation of Iraq, one of the directives was to, you know, to not allow press photographers to capture video of, you know, for example, like the coffins coming home on cargo planes. And there was a real concerted effort by, you know, by the government, you know, working in lockstep with corporate media to suppress real information, to smear anti-war movements and individuals, you know, as, you know, crazy, unpatriotic radicals. I mean, my Congresswoman, Barbara Lee, was the only member of Congress to vote against the authorization of war on Afghanistan. And she was pilloried for it. I mean, she was just trashed for years. Yeah. So I think it's multifold. I think the lack of an anti-war movement, the corporatization of mainstream media, and I think that the real effort at dumbing down of Americans, you know, I mean, just ignorance upon ignorance and, you know, real distortion of facts and misrepresentation and all the things that we know corporate media has always done.
There's one other element, which is, of course, you know, the absence of a communist bloc,
yes.
Right? I mean, the Vietnam War was much more of a war because the Vietnamese had the support of other massive, right, powerful communist countries. And the same goes for the neoliberal nature of Reconstruction, right? Like any kinds of development efforts that the U.S. was doing during the Cold War era, they were competing with Cubans and Russians,
right,
and that a totally different philosophy of how to do development and how to get out of third world status.
Yeah.
And so that totally changed the dynamic of insurgency and counterinsurgency from what it is now when they really have a monopoly.
There's other differences too, right? Like there's it was a conscription army.
That's right.
In Vietnam.
Yeah.
You had people from the store down the street, the family down the road fighting and dying. One of the important pillars of the war in Afghanistan has been, especially lately, separating American troops from the core of the fight, you know,
right,
like the American troops haven't gone really outside the wire in like a decade now, really, because keeping the soldiers alive is an important part of keeping the justification for the war legitimate, because once people have there's no problem killing Afghans, of course, but it's, you know, when Americans are killed, that's when it makes the news and that's when it's reported on.
That was The Brief with John Elmer, Justin Podor, and me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. You can hear us once a month on your favorite podcast provider or bi-weekly by subscribing at patreon.com/thebrief. The Brief is co-produced by Pierre Loisel, John Elmer, Justin Podor, and me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Music by Greg Wilson. Follow us on Twitter @TheBriefPod.